So I've always known I had this in me, and I did what everybody else tried to do, and I tried to ignore it.
Hey, you're listening to the Creative Pop Tart Podcast. I mean, the Creative Pep Talk Podcast, sorry. This isn't about funky pastries. This is about creative careers. We help you build a thriving creative career. I'm your host, Andy J. Pop-Tart. You can follow me at Andy J. Pizza on Instagram, at Andy J. Pizza. So you can go check out all the Creative Pep Talk stuff on there and stay up to date with all of my cool drawings. Go check out my drawings. This episode is supported by In The Making, an original podcast brought to you by Adobe Express, the all-in-one content creation app included in your Creative Cloud membership. If you are trying to boost the YouTube, TikTok, Reels content side of what you're doing, one episode of In The Making that I think will be super useful to you is their episode with John Yushai. I think John's method for including his audience in the process is really inspiring. And if you want to hear about that and more about leveling up your game in the creator economy, just search In The Making in your podcast player to listen. Many thanks to In The Making and Adobe Express for their support. Really needed to rehaul my website. I was talking to some web people, looking around, and I got intrigued by Squarespace's new Fluid Engine, partially because it just sounds cool, but also because it allows you to drag and resize and layer up anything you can imagine. I dove in, rebuilt my site. It's the most me site that I've ever had. I just absolutely love it. Launched it. Got such a great response. Some industry illustration and designy peers even reached out and was like, hey, who coded this thing, man? I'm like, y'all, I did it by myself. No coding with Squarespace's new Fluid Engine. I told him, like, you should go check it out. You're going to be surprised with what you can do. And I built this thing before Squarespace reached out to sponsor the show. So I was like, boom, easy peasy. I was going to tell you about this new site anyway. Go check it out, AndyJPizza.com, if you want to see what I did with it. If you want to try it yourself, make a site that's totally you, where you can build a portfolio, sell content and courses and all kinds of other stuff, head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain with promo code PEPTALK, all one word, all uppercase. Just a heads up, this episode gets a little feisty in terms of the language. So in case your type of parenting style means that you don't want your kids to hear those words, then this episode is one they might want to skip. Maybe you don't let those words enter your own sweet, innocent brain. And boy, do I support you, you sweet baby. But this episode's going to have a little funk to it. Why? Because we've got James Victory on the show. James Victory! He's been a dream guest of mine, someone who fits the episode, the podcast so perfectly. He has his own creative career advice. I'm kind of like good cop, he's kind of like bad cop when it comes to your creative career. Maybe I'm too sweet on you. He'll kick your booty into action. Go check out his YouTube channel, and I'll put it in the show notes at creativepeptalk.com/episodes. But also, James has a new book. It's called Feck Perfection, and it's about facing your fears in your creative career. It's a beautiful book, fully illustrated, tons of wisdom, a career's worth of wisdom. James has posters in the MoMA, okay? That's all you need to know. You don't need to know more than that. And everything else you need to know, you can hear it from his mouth. Here he is, James Victory. I want to go all the way back. I want to give my listeners a little bit of a backstory of who you are and where you came from. And my first question is, what was your ordinary world before the door to the supernatural world of creative career opened up? So what were you before you had ever heard of poster designers?
That's a super question. You know, people ask me, how did I come about doing this?
Yeah,
being a designer. And, you know, I have been pretty good my whole life at being pretty introspective and pretty retrospective. And a lot of this is in, you know, I think a lot of this is in the book, but I was born to do this job.
Yeah.
I was, as a child, I was curious and I was full of wordplay and I made up songs and I drew on everything. And, you know, and none of this was condoned, you know, by school or by family or whatever.
Or encouraged.
You know, I was, no. It was looked down upon. And even to the effect that I was called creative as a child and I knew it wasn't a compliment. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, so, you're a creative child.
Oh, So I've always known I had this in me, and I did what everybody else tried to do, and I tried to ignore it. I tried to, you know, go to a regular university. I tried to do what everybody else does. I tried to, you know, words I hate. I tried to fit in, and then I realized that it's a long, hard process to realize that you don't fit in, because that means you stand out. That means you're vulnerable. And it's taken me quite a long time, Andy, to get comfortable in that. And I'm not entirely comfortable being that open and being that vulnerable now and having people know things about my life and putting my pains and my loves and my relationships in my work, you know? Mm. But that, you know, that's the path. And like I said, I had to ignore it and I had to rail against it until it was you know, clear that, you know, this was the path to take. If you're going to be happy, if you're going to be calm, you know, this is going to be the path to take. And I'm so glad I did. And part of the reason to be so vocal and to be such a teacher about this stuff is that I know there are other people out there who are just, you know, they're stuck in a box and they were put there by uncreative people and they're chomping at the bit and they don't know the first step.
And so, where did you grow up?
I grew up in upstate New York, the northeast corner of New York State, hemmed in by Burlington, Vermont, and Montreal. So a tiny little town with no culture whatsoever. It was we moved there because it was a military base. I lived there until I was 19 years old, and then I moved to New York City.
And what were the, before you moved there, what were the things about home and school that you couldn't, even when you tried, fit into?
I tried. Yeah. So I went to a Catholic high school. So we had to, you know, you had to fit in there and dress like everybody else. And then everybody was going to university and my grades were stellar. I was a smart kid. But I didn't get into the universities that I wanted to. I was an alternate for the Air Force Academy, which is, you know, in Colorado Springs, which is as close as I got. But I did get accepted to the university in my hometown, State University of New York. And I went there for one semester and I was asked to leave with a 0.04 cum because I was working a full-time job, waiting tables so I could, you know, make money. And, I was also working as a national ski patrol because I was a big skier when I was a kid. And basically crying in my car between classes because, you know, I didn't know what to do. And getting kicked out of school was kind of the first step. And then the restaurant that I worked at was a kind of a fancy place for this town. And it was lucky enough to have this chef named Gary Danko. And Gary Danko is now like, he runs a restaurant called Gary Danko's in San Francisco, which is like one of the restaurants you can't get into, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, he fired me twice.
Yeah.
You know, and after the second time he and I were hanging out at the bar, he was this tall, flamingly gay, amazing, wonderful, kind, generous guy with massive hands and wildly creative. And he sat me down and he said, Jim, this was my name then. He said, go to New York City. He fucking pointed the way and I went. And I've been to him in San Francisco a number of times. And every time I go, I crawl there on my knees and I thank him because he was one of the few people who could see through all the bullshit and see why I was getting fired and why I was failing is because I wasn't in love.
And speaking of failure, I want to get back to the story in a second, but you tell a funny story in the book about, or a powerful story in the book about failure and being on the winter ski patrol. Can you just share that real quick?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I didn't fail when I was on the ski patrol, but
or just with part, the restaurant of, and yeah, school and all.
Part of my gig as a ski patrol was, you know, like a lot of standing around. You know,
yes.
Standing at the bottom, standing at the top, you know, waiting for something to happen. And that, you know, that doesn't, for someone who's, you know, ain't got ants in his pants. That's not cool. So I used to, try to teach kids and cute young girls how to ski.
Yeah.
And the process was, I found very interesting. Even then I found very interesting because nobody wanted to fall. And what they would do with their bodies in order that they don't fall was painful to watch, you know? And they would look like basically like a sheet of plywood trying to go down the mountain. Right. So I had to like teach them how to relax, and I had to teach them, you know, to fall and say, listen, if you're not falling, you're not skiing. So just be cool with that. Just relax and let it go. Cause if you're not, then you're going to break something too. Cause you're all like, you know, stiff as a board and scared.
Yes.
But, you know, but I learned early on that, you know, that was a huge part of the process was failure and accepting it. And Andy, I think my next book has just got to be, you know, James Victoria failed like a motherfucker. Cause I've got a litany, a huge list of people who have failed me and people who've told me I, you know, don't belong and stuff. And I, you know, I think any quality creative has that, you know, nobody has just plucked and said, you know, here you go. You're a genius, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And so, all right, getting back to the story, that before you go to New York, is poster design already a thing in your mind? Is that something you'd already discovered?
Wow, good question. in this hometown, there were two entities that kind of populated the town. It's called Plattsburgh, New York, and it's the military base that had been there forever, and the State University. So that was the college. My dad worked in the military. My mom worked in the reference department of the university library. Yeah. And I went to school in town, but we lived outside of town. So I'd get out of school about 2:30 and I'd walk over to the building. And I had about an hour and a half before she got out of work and could drive me home. So what she would do is she knew I liked to draw. So she would give me, you know, stacks of typing paper and a pen or a pencil. And she just pulled out these reference books off the shelf and said, here, look through these. And she didn't know, but what she was pulling out was books of art history and books of design annuals from Italian design annuals from the 50s and the 60s and graffiche annuals. Mm. So I was thumbing through these and reading these names and looking at this work that, you know, that we would think of as the, you know, the pantheon of design history. All of that stuff that Philip Meggs collected and, you know, all the genius stuff of all the Polish guys and Mueller Brockman and, you know, just the genius stuff. And I kind of, it spoke to me then. And I kind of acquired a massive design history at, you know, 11 years old and, you know, not knowing. But the stuff really spoke to me, and it was vibrant and just the colors. And again, growing up in a town with no culture, with no, you know, museum or something, you don't see this stuff every day, especially the, and even now I feel bad for, you know, American students, because they don't get exposed to that kind of stuff, you know, the European stuff.
True. And so when you went to New York mm-hmm. at 19, were you then trying to do that thing all over again where you're trying to fit into what is good poster design, end quotes?
You know, I went to, at 19, after I failed at one university, I got my dad was, he was working in the military, but he also had a ski shop. So I, you know, hence the heavy skiing family. And he brought home a flyer one day that somebody had come by and was trying to, you know, sell him some advertising. And it was this tiny little design studio in, you know, in town. So I went to that studio, and they basically made, you know, menus for restaurants, you know, mm-hmm. and dry cleaner windows and that kind of stuff. And that was an influence for me to kind of like go, oh, you can make a living doing this, perhaps. So the guy who helped me there, his name was Pat Donahoe, and he was a genius who was kind of like at the end of his days, and he just wanted to hide from all of it. But he was like a huge advertising guy in the 60s, and he'd done a lot of stuff for NASA and done some beautiful things, and then just wanted to make birch bark canoes and have a small design agency, right? So he said, oh, you should go to school for this. And I'm like, oh, there's what? Huh? So I applied to like all the schools on the East Coast. And I got accepted into all of them. And I wanted to go to the School of Visual Arts because it was in New York. And I thought, oh, the city of vision, that's where I'm going. So I went to SVA. And I got to SVA. And I kind of felt like it was at least the way it was taught then, or at least the classes that I unfortunately was either put into or selected. I don't think I was even smart enough to select classes, but it felt like a bit of an assembly line. Like everybody was walking through the 4 years with a little shoebox in front of them. And they would go from class to class, and the instructor would put something in that shoebox. And at the end of the 4 years, you would have your shoebox full. And I'd already seen this European stuff, and I'm like, grids? What's that? Yeah. You know, color theory? What? I'm supposed to wait. I'm supposed to look outside of myself at some chart to tell me what fucking colors to use. That's an interesting idea. You know, so I think I had much more of a painter in me than a designer, you know? And luckily one of my instructors I finally got into in my second year, because I didn't last at SVA very long either. I was asked to leave SVA. Yeah. But I think in my second year I took a class that was poster design with a wonderful old Polish guy named Rafał Olbinski. And he brought in a chunk of his collection of the European stuff. And I'm like, oh, I gotta go. Yeah. I'm out of here. Thank you. Yep. And that's when I actually literally went to Europe and met all these guys I'd seen in the books when I was 11. I went and rang their doorbells and went looking for them and wrote articles about them. And, that's when my real education, Andy, started when I left school, because I realized I didn't know shit. Mm. That's when I started reading. And reading good stuff, you know, reading like Gertrude Stein and poetry and, the literature I was supposed to have read before.
Yeah.
So it's scary when you realize you don't know anything.
But it's the first step, right?
Oh, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. If you're brave enough to take it, it's amazing.
That thing that you talk about in your book, actually, the I don't know.
Yeah. 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 You got to teach your tongue to say, I don't know. It's the best. It's completely freeing.
There's a Epictetus quote that says, you can't learn what you think you already know. And I take that. I think about it all the time. I think about there's a humility, there's a humbling that's required to get good taste and to develop and all that. And I think sometimes when you go to art school and you're kind of force fed a bunch of ideas and there's, I'm not just shitting on art school. I think there's a ton of really great things that happen there.
Of course.
But I think that some people, when they get kind of sold this point of view, and then they take it upon themselves that it's their own, and there's this kind of chip on their shoulder, they don't have that ability to empty themselves out and develop their own point of view.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. If you think Massimo Vignelli is God, then you're pretty much screwed.
Yes, exactly. Because this is his,
because all you're doing is following. You're making no contribution at all, unless you use blue, and that's huge.
So here's an interesting thing. When you're at SVA and you're seeing the difference between the grids and the shoebox approach and all the rules and all that kind of stuff, and then you're seeing these European posters, I just have a sense that you must have had some kind of internal mechanism to say, at least from your point of view, one of these are good and the other one's not. And I just wonder what, over the years even, maybe you have
figured out what you think is good design or good poster design even. Mm-hmm. What is it?
You know, it's a great question, Andy. And I think there's two, it makes me think of two different things. I think it's not that one of is good and one is bad. I was learning graphic design and that one was rules.
Mm-hmm.
But I was looking at Genius and they seemed to have no rules.
Yeah.
Right. It was the paper was as free as the canvas, right? There was a level of artistry. And I think that leads to the other side of it. So one part is like, okay, the design thing is fine, but it looks like a bunch of rules. Mm. And the other side was rules that could be critiqued by a teacher. You know, yes, no, yes, no.
Right.
The right way and the wrong way. Right?
A rubric of some kind.
Right. But... And the other side is that it there was a level of me looking at them both and saying, well, why can't they both? I mean, why do I need to discern between mm-hmm. art and design? And that's the thing that people catch with, you know, people try to get me all the time with, you know, I still, especially if I go to university, like they, you know, to talk, and I don't really show work anymore, but they'll know some of my work and they'll say, okay, so like this Dead Indian poster, like you didn't have a client. So that's like more like art than design. And I'm like, oh, you're one of those people who gives a shit.
Yeah.
Cause I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
You can call it what you want. I mean, you can call it Charlie Daniels. I don't care.
Yeah.
Oh, but please don't call it Charlie Daniels. Jesus, that was the worst.
Those posters, that series that you have in the MoMA, what is it that – because I think that they're doing something specific. They're doing something powerful. They're doing something quote-unquote good.
Yeah.
And it seems like you definitely have this kind of – maybe it's a series of – core values, whether they're subconscious or conscious or whatever, but it seems like you have a definition of good. And what is a good poster?
I'm gonna use Cassandra, A.M. Cassandra, the French poster designer. He said a good poster enters through the eye and explodes in the brain. Mm. So there's this whole level of timing involved. You look at it and you take it in, and you might see, you know, you might see a big picture and a little word. And then when you read the little word, there's some relationship between that and the picture, or there's some detail, or there's like levels of meaning, and it just gets bigger and bigger inside of your head. Mm-hmm. And for me, the stuff that's in the MoMA, you know, most of it I made when I was, you know, 29 or 30.
Yeah.
But they all came, they weren't jobs. Wasn't like somebody came to me and said, hey, James, we need a poster about, you know, but they were situations that happened in my city and in my country and in, you know, my life. So they were me as a citizen reacting and saying, hey, I've got these tools and I can, you know, I can, I know printers, you know, I know how to get this shit up out on the street. For other people to react. And I just got, you know, I think one, because I was just full of piss and vinegar and I had to do these things. These were just like, just driven. Yes. That makes it so much easier. And also, it also makes them pregnant with meaning. You know, I still get emails or notes from people who see the work and they're like, dude, you know, that means a lot to me that they can still have legs and they're still viable.
Mm. It almost seemed like a series of good design in terms of those posters communicated James Victorie's point of view.
Sure.
In the same way that you did for clients. I think that the project you did with the, I can't remember the exact what office it is, but it's basically, I think it's getting work for ex-cons.
Oh, the New York City, right? Department of Probation.
Yes.
Wow. That was amazing. That was amazing.
Yeah. What a project.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? What kind of like,
yeah, that was a super, just the serendipity and the timing was amazing. We got contacted by a pal of mine, architect Jim Bieber, wonderful guy, super talented guy. And he had gotten the job, the gig, to redesign the 33 offices of the New York City Department of Probation, the 33 offices around the city. And these are offices that if you got in trouble, not enough to go to jail, trouble, you needed to report to one of these 33 offices, whether, you know, it was like a couple times a week or once a week or a couple times a month or whatever. And you sat and waited and you fill out a form and you went and you talked to somebody through a little hole in a glass and you went and talked to your probation officer and you said, yeah, I've been a good boy, you know, this kind of thing. Yeah. So we were tagged with that thin pentimento of graphic design, which is type and color.
Right.
Right. The DOP didn't have, it was just drab and the carpet smelled like piss and the ceiling tiles were falling in and Jim fixed all that and changed all the furniture and did, you know, amazing job. And we added some level of signage, like, you know, bathroom this way. And they had no logo. So we gave them a logo. They had no identity. So we kind of gave them a system, a very simple system and a font to follow through with. And then, you know, the entire project lasted about probably a month or less because there was whenever the government has money or budget, it usually has to be spent within a you know, one of their quarters. So we had no time and we were working directly with this guy, Vince Schiraldi, who was running the DOP, and he was an amazing guy. And it was kind of a situation as like, it was like, as long as you don't say anything bad, you can say anything you want. And early in the process, we were, you know, this my tiny little studio, the three of us were having lunch and we said, you know what this client needs, these probationers, you know what these people need? They need art. They need art in their life. Let's give them art. And, you know, just like I would do for New York City. New York City needs art in the streets, you know. You got to go to a special room and pay money to go see art. It's fucked up shit right there. Yeah. That's right. The communist in me talking. So we decided to make these as luck would have it, I said, Oh, wait, when I was a kid, there was a poster that I had in my room that meant a lot to me. And it was a kitten hanging from a from a rope and it said, "Hang in there, kitty. We gotta do that." And what we did was we basically did parodies of those really super bad, you know, inspirational posters, like a picture of an eagle and it says vision, you know, and four jets flying and it says teamwork, you know?
Yeah.
So we did our parodies of those and it ended up being super, super meaningful to both the staff and the visitors. It was crazy because we were allowed to speak in an adult tone. We were allowed to say things that, quite frankly, I think this audience has never been spoken to that way before, you know, directly and honestly. And I think that's the thing that always has always turned me on about graphic design is that it always has this, it has that potential if you let it. But most clients and most designers don't think about that. That's the subjective part that they don't put in it, you know. And most clients don't think about that either, and the difference is not in the budget. Do you know what I mean? Like you don't have to pay me more for to play. You don't have to pay me more to move people. I want to move people anyway.
Yeah,
you know. But I think that's the ultimate level of ink on paper is when you can move people and you can make something sexy and powerful and memorable.
Yeah. So I think that series and the series for the moment and all your work, I think you have an ability to know your point of view and put it into the work that you're making. And I wonder if you could talk about what the process of that looks like, even in a detailed way of, you know, no matter who's listening to this, they're all creative people. Some of them are going to be making music. Some of them are posters. Whatever. It obviously goes down to knowing a point of view that you want to put into a creation and somehow pinning that down. And then you do a great job of wrangling it even into a punchline where there's a clear, you know,
that explosion in the mind that mm-hmm. happens that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just talk about that process of how you find whatever that point of view, that little nugget that's going to turn into a piece and what that looks like?
Yeah. Yeah. I can tell it in a funny story. I had this assistant in the last bunch of years when I was back in New York. His name is Chris, and he was a wonderful guy, super smart, really enjoyed his company. We enjoyed being together, and we did a lot of great work. He was pretty instrumental in the DOP thing. But when he started, he was fresh out of school. And whenever we got a gig, I'd say, "Hey, Chris, you know, Esquire called," and blah, blah, blah. And he'd go, "Oh, cool. What do they want?" And I used to have to, I felt like Sister Ignatius Notorious, and I wanted to like smack his knuckles with a ruler, right? And say, "Bitch, I don't know what they want. They called me. I guess they want me." Yeah. You know?
They want what you want.
That's right. I don't know what they want. And when a client does call me and tells me what they want, I give it to them in 5 minutes and I get paid. And I take my name off of it. So I don't know what people want. It's impossible to know what people want. People want, you know, kittens and porn. I don't know. So my process is so much more powerful than trying to guess what people want. And my process is I sit back and I say, what do I want to say? Mm-hmm. What opportunity do we have here? And how can I play? How can I, you know, take work and turn it into serious play? How can I play and again fill this thing with meaning and emotion? You know, it's funny. I often think of like I think it was the very first Batman, who was it that played the Joker?
Keaton?
No, it might have been Keaton.
Jack Nicholson.
When Jack Nicholson played the Joker, yeah. I often find myself thinking like after he's fallen into the acid, and the next time you see him, you see like the back. He's talking, but all you see is the back of a chair, you know. And he spins around and he says, "Wait till they get a load of this." And I'm like that. That's how I feel in the studio. I'm like, that's what I want to get to. I want to get to this point where I'm like, I'm like, and I'm like showing it to my wife and I'm showing it to everybody going, oh, and then I go to, then I just say out loud, oh, they're never going to do this. They're never going to do this. And you know what, Andy? They fucking do it.
Yes.
They do it because that's what the audience wants. The audience doesn't want to be, you know, told.
Yeah.
They want to be part of the joke. They want to be spoken up to. They want their when in the DOP, the great thing in the DOP was like Vince Schiraldi told me the story that, you know, he was in the downtown New York office when it opened, and he saw one of the probationers was reading this like small chunk of text that we had on the poster that like tells the truth about, you know, whatever we're trying to say, you know, like there ain't no shortcuts. It was a poster. One of the posters said there ain't no shortcuts. And this text explained that. And he said the probationer is bending over and looking at the thing. And then he stands up and he looks at his probation officer and he says, "That's what I think." Because I think if I can just relax and play and tell my truth and put it in my work, it has that meaning for other people. And the way we call it in the book is that in the particular lies the universal. You know, the more honest I can be and the more vulnerable I can be in my work, the more meaning it will have for other people. And, you know, and you, your podcast is a success because you do a very good job of not asking those fucking stock questions.
Yeah.
You know, like whenever I go speaking and I'm like, I say, "Oh, who's going to introduce me?" And they say me, "Oh yeah, you know, Tony over there." And I say, "Hey Tony, I hope you're not going to read the boring bio." And he just gets this, you know, they always get this look on their face like, "Oh shit." Like, "Dude, you've known me for 5 minutes. You can make up something. Come on."
You know what? One thing that you said that I just want to highlight, something that I've found through doing the podcast, this is like a subconscious thing that's happened. If I'm brainstorming work, whether that's illustration or the podcast or whatever, I think it came from doing the podcast, I find myself kind of pacing, drawing, you know, whatever, but I'm repeating what you just said, which is, what do I want to say?
Yeah. Yeah. Those are the most, those are so, Andy, those are such powerful words. What do I want to say?
It is.
And you know, and it's amazing because so few people use that. I'm like, dude, it's free. Just, you know.
Yes.
No, there's rules, James. There's rules here.
But you've got to find that spark of, and because what I want to say is, there's always a bunch of fluff around it at first. And I'm like, yeah, it's kind of like that, whatever. But you keep digging until it's like, boom, that thing.
Yeah.
And that's when you say, you got to go show your wife, or you got to go show this person or the client or whatever. Cause you're like, I got it. I know what I want to tell him.
Yeah.
I want to go tell him.
Yeah. It's funny because I call it whittling. So it's like taking a blunt stick that I could poke you with and you'd go, hey, stop it. But if I whittle it down further and further and further, and I make it sharper and sharper. And then when I poke you, you're like, oh, motherfucker.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the difference. That's what I want.
That's it.
That's what I want. Robert Frost once said he wanted to write a poem that was barbed.
Beautiful. I have this thing where I'll do a half hour, an hour on an idea, and I'll work really hard to figure out how to say it or whatever. And then I'll have some person on Instagram recap what I said and then say it more succinctly. And
yeah.
Nothing pains me like that. I'm like, damn it, I missed it.
I missed that one.
Yes, it's there.
I left it there on the ground.
Yes. And so I think you're spot on there.
Well, it's funny because last night I had my in-laws over for dinner, and my kids were running around, and my son had a tape measure, and he pulled it out to like 3 feet, and then he's whipping it back and forth, you know, terrorizing his sister. And, I said, Wyatt, I said, you just can't, whip it around like a weapon. And my wife just busted out in laughing. She said, oh my God. She said, you know what I heard? I said, what did you hear? She said, I thought you said, you can't just whip it out like Hugh Hefner. That's brilliant.
Oh,
that's just one of those things that if you're really kind of paying attention and you're in the flow, I'm like, oh my God, baby, write that down. You got to use that. That is so great. And the visual of that, you can't get out of your head.
No, that is ridiculous. I think that's you training your brain to notice those things.
Or to pay attention to it. Yeah.
Yeah. To pay attention. Now, one of your most watched videos is this idea of how do you find your style? And I think you have a bunch of interesting things about that. Well, actually, I'll tell you this. When I was teaching at the art school locally, this is a few years ago, I was always trying to show them videos of different people who exemplified that X factor. And I didn't quite have a feel of what it was, but I was showing them a bunch of different videos. And I remember showing them one of you, and it really clicked for me because I realized that what you had was, you had a context that people needed and understood, which is poster design. But you didn't just fit in, you stood out. You had a way of doing poster design that was recognizable, understandable. People knew James Victoria doesn't just make posters. He makes posters with grit, and they say something and they stab you, they're barbed, right? And it was just this, like, for me it clicked, this thing of fitting in and standing out and striking this really kind of, it's not unlike a focal point of making a pattern and then breaking it. And I wonder if you can speak to, you learned a lot from these masters about what it means to make posters, and then at some point you learned how to make posters like you.
Yeah.
And I wonder what's the break in that? Cause that's where it gets interesting.
Yeah. First of all, bravo for you to trying to get students to understand that. Cause that scares the shit out of them, because that leaves them standing out in the middle of a field.
100%.
You know, oh, you just put a target on my back. Thanks. Thanks, prof. Yeah. For me, a big part of the process was this thing that I know if I learned it or read it a bunch of years ago. I think I read it, but it was in a business book. But it was this line that says, first, learn everything, then forget it, and then design. Like, first, like, you know, be an interesting person. You know about design history and know about art and know about all these things.
Life,
have a girlfriend, lose a girlfriend, whatever. Mm-hmm. Then forget it. And forgetting it means let it just seep in, let it become, you know, your blood and your sinew and your muscle and your, design. And then, you know, then, and when you're designing, like my thing, whenever I'm talking to, opportunity to talk to designers, I say, listen, if you go home and your library is full of design books, then you don't get it. Mm-hmm. Then you're myopic. Then you're coming from such a small place.
Yes.
Do you know? Because that's all you know. That's like these, like I used to, I had a girlfriend years ago who was a yoga instructor, and she was like, mm-hmm. on the cover of Yoga magazine, and she was like, but she like ate, slept, and breathed yoga, and she was the most boring chick in the fucking world.
Yeah.
Strong back. but boring girl. Do you know what I mean? And she taught me a lot. It was like, wow, that's totally not cool. No. And I think, you know, if you as a designer can like where it's even to the point where it's not so precious, mm-hmm. where it's not so precious, where, so when every job comes in, you don't go, Oh my God. And your sphincter shrinks and you're like, you get scared. And, you know, and that happens to me too. It's like, if someone comes to me and sure. they've got like a bundle of money, I'm like, oh shit. And I'm like, okay, James, just breathe. It's cool. It's the same today as it was yesterday. Just play. Yeah.
Yes.
You know?
And that's all that whole thing going back to just to hit upon it. Cause I think this happened to me a million times. I heard Lisa Hanawalt say this on a podcast once. And I just want to always try to reference things when they come up. But she said that she'd get these editorial jobs and editorial illustration. And she'd instantly go to that thing of what do they want? AKA what would an editorial illustrator do?
Yeah.
And she realized, like, no, they came to you because they want you. They want your thing.
Yeah. It's funny. I had a relationship with Esquire magazine for a bunch of years, where I, you know, would go drinking in the office after hours. And I knew the chief editor and the art director. It was a pal of mine. I was at his wedding. He married my old assistant, you know, it was pretty in deep with Esquire. Did a bunch of covers for them and did a lot of great work. And one day, and there's a million hilarious stories about them accepting work. But one day we were having a comment, and I was like, the creative director, his name was David Kirkarito. And I said, Kirk, and I said, I send you some crazy shit and you print it.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, James, I don't hire you as an illustrator. I hire you as an artist.
Yes.
And it was just, and I don't know if that was more freeing or not.
Right.
You know, more freeing, or like, oh shit, now I got to do that thing.
Artist.
Yeah, shit. Oh, I got to put that thing on. I guess, you know, get out your paintbrushes. Yeah. You know, if you can train yourself to that, they're all the same. Every single job mm-hmm. is the same, because it's all you relaxing and just being able to play and ask yourself, you know, what do I think?
Yes.
What do I want to do? If I have a poster job that I know is going to be seen by real people, like I'm working on one right now for Tulane University, and I know that it's going to be out in the, you know, in the street. And I'm like, oh my God, what reaction do I want? What kind of timing do I want to build into this thing? You know, I've got a line of text that I have to use. So it's not just like a big green circle with nothing on, you know, nothing else. Yeah. I have a line of text and I'm like, how do I want people to read this? I want them to read it. I want them to read it the third time they walk by where they finally go, oh, do you see what that says? And where it proves itself in their head. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, that's my process, is just like, how can I do that?
Yes.
And then halfway through the process, I go, I can't do this. Of course. You know, I mean, that's like, you know, I go
that's
through,
the,
I,
that's
I,
the cocoon and the, you know,
yeah, I go through all the same things, all the early sketches for every single job that I make are the exact same sketches my mom could come up with.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, we all do that. We all go to the obvious things, the cliches, but we have to learn how to go past those and tear those cliches open, or even just turn those cliches upside down.
Yes.
You know, the biggest compliment early on in my career was when I was making, you know, especially those really simple posters from years ago, people would say, all he did was, and I'm like, yeah, dude, that's all I did. And it's fucking awesome, isn't it?
And I think about that. I've been building a series out on this idea of the three-act structure, and it's kind of what you're describing, this process of thesis, which is like, this is the way things are, which is like, these are the obvious ideas. This is what's on the table. Antithesis, which is everything deconstructing, you're falling apart. You're like, what am I doing? I'm a terrible, you know, and it's all falling to chaos. And then synthesis is those two things together. It's like the obvious things plus the deconstructed chaos that doesn't make any sense. And then somehow those come together to create. And obviously that's a simplification of the process, because the chaos really is chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And but that's what it sounds like you're describing.
Dude, you should write that book, dude. You'd be like the next Austin Kleon.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I don't know how to write.
Damn, did I just hear you say that? Oh, damn.
Yeah.
Did you just lie to me? You just fucking lied and to yourself. That's crazy.
It's not a good attitude. That's a stumbling block for me.
Amazing. Andy J, that's amazing to hear you say that. It really is.
Yeah.
I can't write.
I'm working on it. I have a book agent. She's pep talking me like, no, you can write. Like,
you can
there's
write
something about it. I think writing is, and I wonder if this is your experience writing that book. I think maybe I can write, and it's helped me to hear writers talk about how painful writing can be.
Oh, it's horrible.
With the rewriting and the, you know, trying to think in that way is quite a hell of a thing.
Well, here's the truth. Yeah. Here's the biggest truth I know about writing is that writing isn't hard. It's the sitting that's hard.
Yeah.
It's like being able to sit for an hour and a half, 2 hours and, you know, and just pay attention and do that thing is that's the hardest part. And, you know, when I was working on Victoria or Who Died and Made You Boss, my first book, the big, huge coffee table book, I was looking around for a ghostwriter because I didn't want to do it.
I'm in those shoes.
Yeah. And then I was talking to my editor, real smart gal, Deborah Aronson from, she's at Fiden now, I think. She was at Abrams then. And she said, well, why don't you write it? And I said, I can't write. Yeah. But I couldn't find a ghostwriter. So I reluctantly, you know, did it myself. And then I handed her over the transcript. And then she handed it back. And all she did was like move commas and, you know, take run-on sentences and change. And I said, Deborah, what did you do? She said, oh, no, you fixed your copy. I said, no, you're supposed to make it sound like someone who's smart. I thought that's what an editor did.
Like, yeah, fix this.
Put it in English, damn it.
Yeah. Yes.
But at the same time, I was reading Anthony Bourdain's first book, Kitchen Confidential. And it just blew me away the way he wrote. Because he wrote the way he spoke. And I was like, oh, damn. If you just, and here it is, the same thing in graphic design. If you just tell the truth, it works.
True.
Don't try to write, Andy. Just try to be you.
Try to tell the truth. That's so good. I've been reading this book. It's called Poking a Dead Frog. It's interviews with comedians. And reading that it's similar to what you're describing with Anthony Bourdain, where I'm like, reading it and I'm just getting into that truth telling, that space of feeling where like, oh, they're just like, right. That's what writing is. And I think that there's, it almost trains your brain to get into that play space. And that has been helping. That's for sure.
Cool.
That's super encouraging.
Cool.
So one last thing I want to say was your new book, Effect Perfection, it seems a little bit pointed. This is kind of a joke, but it seems kind of pointed at the design industry. Like sometimes I have a feeling that you love design, maybe love hate design. You know, you love art, you love posters. And, you know, you kind of told the story by going through school and all that and feeling that. And I wonder if you just kind of want to say, like, it's not about the kerning. It's not about the perfection. It's not about the grids. And actually, I think you're right. But do you feel like this book is pointed at some of that?
You know, it's funny. I hadn't thought about that. I hadn't thought about that, but I can totally see that. I can totally see it. And listen, so when I said the sitting is the hard part, my process for writing was I would get up at 4:30 in the morning because it was the only time that I could have like solitude. I knew I had solitude for an hour and a half. And I'd sit out on the porch with a blanket around me and my laptop in the dark. And I'd have a little camping coffee maker because I didn't want to wake anybody up. And I'd sit there writing. And while I was writing, I had the voices in my head, the critics, right? Mm. And the critics were my New York design pals.
Yes.
They were saying, you're going to say that? And I'm like, just fucking shut up. Shut up. Go away. Right? It was really difficult to say, oh, dude, you're gonna do that? You're going to say those things? You know? Yeah. Because, and then I had to remind myself that this is not a design book. It's not for designers. It's for creative. Like you said earlier, it's for your audience. It's for people who think they have a creative bone in their body. And it doesn't matter if they're doing gardening or parenting or whatever, you know, do it creatively. Yeah. And yes, I do think that there are obviously things in the design community, these cliches that designers fall back on, and it just makes their lives easy. I understand, but it also makes their lives small.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like the whole kerning or typography thing. Who gives a flying fuck? Yeah. Who cares what typeface it is? Just fucking tell the truth. It's the truth works in any font. I don't care. You know, and don't give me this fucking, oh, Comic Sans, har, har, har. Don't give me this fucking cliche, dumbass designer jokes. You know, yeah. I think the industry makes it hard for people because we have those cliches about, but I think that the business can be so much more interesting personally for people if they understand that who they are and what they have and their sense of the macabre or their sense of sexuality or their sense of humor or their sense of shyness, you know, becomes part of the work and is much more important than any decoration that you can do. And the thing is, what you're doing then is you're putting yourself out there as being vulnerable and authentic and weird, because weird is a big, huge part of this book.
Yes.
And when you do that and you do it well, and I see it in your work and in your life, when you do that and you do it well, what happens is the most beautiful thing in the world is that other people relate to that and say, Andy J. Pizza, you're weird? Oh my God, I'm weird too. I thought I was the only one.
Yep.
And what happens is you create relationships like that and you create businesses like that and you create an audience like that and then you fucking get paid for it. How about that?
Yeah.
And then you don't have to sit around at dinner with a bunch of designers critiquing the fucking typography on the menu. Oh my God, slip my fucking wrists.
The way I think about it, and I feel like you're kind of the person who, the voice that tells Luke Skywalker when it's time to quit listening to Yoda. Like, you know what I'm saying? Because I think that's the hero's journey, is there comes a time where the mentor can't take you any further.
Yeah.
And you have to be your own hero.
Yeah.
And I think that all of those cliches are examples of people selling themselves out to the rules. And the rules, we all know, learning the rules, and you've said it here, learning the rules is a part of the process. But it's not the end result. It's
yeah,
not the,
yeah. If you follow the rules, you're going to be thoroughly unhappy.
Yes.
You know, because life is just going to get smaller and smaller.
maybe you can leave us and end us here with what you say about owning your weird. I can pitch it harder than that, but I don't want to steal your thunder.
Pitch it harder. Give me a clue. What did I say?
you're talking about what makes you weird when you're young.
Yeah. What makes you weird as a kid? Yeah. What makes you weird as a kid makes you great today. And it's like I have people who come, who want to work with me here at the ranch. We do workshops here at the ranch, and they come from around the world. Literally. And they come and they're like mid-career, you know, or they've been in the business for a couple of years and they've got the house and the family and the stuff going on, and they're crying in their car on the way home from work, you know, and they're like, you know, what do I do? What can I, and I have to just remind them of their creativity, of why they got involved in the first place. And I have to remind them of, you know, of what made them interesting and what made them weird as a kid. And what that is where their power comes from, because that's why they got involved in this business in the first place and didn't become a tax attorney.
Yeah.
Because they felt some belonging to the creative world, but then they got into business and they learned how to make money and forgot. You know, I mean, the first line in the book says, you know, we were all born wildly creative. Some of us just forgot, you know? So it's not my job to tell anybody anything, but it's my job to remind people of the power they already have. You don't have to learn design. You don't have to learn the rules. You have to pay attention to yourself, and you have to learn how to make yourself happy. And that will make other people happy. And then all of a sudden you're known for being you. You know, my job is to get paid to be James Victory, not to try.
Yes, that's fantastic. I'm going to ask you one quick end question. I told you that was going to be the end, but this is the real end.
Oh, you talk about
you talk about vibrations in your book, and you talk about getting into this meeting with a guy in business, and he's all jazzed out of his mind about his own life, and then he starts talking about the business and the brief, and he's like lost all his vibration, lost all of his excitement. And I wonder, I know that just from reading your story and knowing about you, that you've had the ebbs and flows of those vibrations of going into feeling like you're right in the center of it and super excited to feeling like you're out of it and not knowing what to do. What do you have in your utility belt to zap yourself back into getting those vibrations going when you notice that's kind of when you've lost it?
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. One is that, I never lose it. I just forget, you know, it's not something that you go looking for, you know, it's there all the time. It's there all the time. You know, your voice, your energy, your vibrations, it's there all the time. It's just like, you know, it just something, you know, like with the people who come to the workshops, it needs to be deeply unearthed, you know, for a lot of people. And a lot of these people who come here, I mean, they go home and they fucking, you know, they change their lives, and it's awesome to watch. But the I think the biggest thing, the most approachable answer is that, we need to learn how to be gentle on ourselves, because, you know, you can't have it all the time. You can't, you know, I can't access that all the time. It's like, I've never had like a 9-to-5 creative work, because I can't imagine trying to be creative at not from 9-to-5. Okay. You can finish your coffee now. Go be creative until lunchtime, you know? So the biggest thing is to be gentle on ourselves and know that, you know, it's the muse, and it sometimes wants to go, you know, away. And we have to just relax and know that it'll come back, and trust ourselves, and trust our weirdness, and trust our intuition, and all these tools that we were born with. And, you know, we have it, and it'll be there when we need it. You know, I've had a lot of downtime lately, energy wise, because of the accident that I went through. And I have to remind myself constantly and say, tomorrow may be better, and all I need is 3 hours, and I will clear the decks. The energy will be there. Everything will be there. And I will, like, poof, miraculously. And on top of it, miraculously, everything seems to always get done. And if it doesn't get done, it doesn't need, didn't need to happen. So you gotta have to accept, you know, those wonderful things about life.
You kind of described in the book, after you hit 35, you had done more than you'd really set out to do. And it seemed like there was a low point there of that vibration leaving, or this kind of energy leaving, and this kind of big questioning thing.
It was huge. Yeah. That was creepy, man. That was not creepy. That was just like, that was hard. That was hard. That was me resisting being me. Mm. You know, I'd been a graphic designer. You pointed out something earlier. You said the journey of the hero. The journey of the hero is definitely the chapters in my book are the journey of the hero. It goes from, you know, understanding a voice all the way through to purpose. You know, it's all, you know, Joseph Campbell is heavy throughout the book. But I had left my purpose behind, and I was a commercial graphic designer, and it was thoroughly, you know, unappealing, and I became it took me a long time. Well, actually, what had to happen, it was a huge explosion had to happen. And I went through a divorce, and that's, you know, unfortunately, that's what happens, has to happen sometimes, to shake you out of your tree, you know? And I, it took me like 5 to 7 years to figure out how powerful and how strong I was. And it scares me, you know, even now I'm like, and now I had another big terrible shakeup with this accident. And, you know, the way my wife describes it, I broke 10 ribs in a collarbone. I'm like busted all over. And the way my wife describes it is she said, your heart is just getting bigger and your body needs to make room for it. Mm. So that, you know, that's what I'm doing now. I'm just like, I'm going through that process again of growing. It's like the classic, you know, what it takes for a lobster to, you know, the painful process of getting out of its shell so it can get to a, you know, so we can grow.
Yeah.
But we all have to go through that. And we don't want to.
No.
We don't want to.
No, everyone wants to avoid pain.
Oh, avoid pain at all costs. Yeah. And
unfortunately,
let's just talk about typography.
Yeah. That's what I like to do on this, you know, creative professional podcast, is let's talk about pain. That's normal. Well, James, thank you so much for giving me an hour of your time. This is like been phenomenal.
It's been a real pleasure, man. It's been really great to talk to you. It's you know, we met a bunch of years ago, and you know, in a big crowded room, and I'm glad we got to sit down together.
Me too. Thanks,
Superman.
Go check out, go get James Victorie's book, Feck Perfection, right now. Wherever you get your books, go check it out. Go find it. This thing is beautifully illustrated. It's chocked full of creative career insights. And it's great. Go check it out. James Victorie, you know, I feel like we're different sides of the same coin. If you find me to be a little bit too cuddly, a little bit too cute, a little bit, not some, maybe you love me, but sometimes you need something a little edgier, a little grittier, a little bit more kick in the pants, go check out James Victorie. He's also super lovely, and he'll make you feel great and excited, and get you started on making the work that you're born to make. Go check it out. Feck Perfection, this guy, thank you, man, for being on the podcast. You are so brilliant, and you're doing such important work. We love you. We appreciate you. Hope to have you on again soon, man. Thank you so much. Thanks to Yoni Wolf and the band Y for our theme music. Thanks to Alex Sugg for the soundtrack to this show. You can go listen to the soundtrack. Makes for great instrumental music to work to at Spotify or Apple Music. Search Creative Pep Talk Soundtrack. You'll find it. Thanks, Alex. And thanks to me for editing this show. We are going to be right back next week. And until then, stay pepped up.